The Man Who Built Boxes is the title of one of the stories in your book. Why did you select that as the title, the title cut, if you will?
I thought a lot about this. I had two other stories that I wanted to use as the title, and one practical reason was one was a little too long to put on the title with the subtitle and other stories and then some graphic art and then the author's name. And so I kept coming back to The Man Who Built Boxes because there's a loose theme among many of the characters in this book, in this collection, and it has to do with people who have, and here's the tired metaphor, who have boxed themselves in one way or another.
How much of you, Frank Tavares, appears in character in this book?
Little bits and pieces here and there. There may be an expression from a character. There may be a feeling or an insecurity that a character portrays in one way or another that I'm familiar with. But I don't think even folks that know me well, although this is not a challenge I think I want to lay out, I don't think people will recognize anything more than just a little sliver of me here and there. And that's one of the things that I think is pretty common among writers. Of course, part of you is going to appear in the different characters and maybe even in some of the plot lines based on experiences that you've had.
The first story in the collection is titled My First Ex-Wife's Third Wedding.
Yes.
And I'm reading that and I'm thinking, this sounds too real to be made up. Is that you in the story? It's not, is it?
Well, that one is first person, and there are some stories I write first person, not because it's me, but because sometimes in an early draft, it's a little easier, not always. So there are a number of stories that start in first person, and then I end up rewriting them in third person. In that particular story, I have to confess, because I have been married more than once. I'm currently married going into my 23rd year, so I think I finally figured it out. But the first line in that story actually was from a conversation on the phone with my first wife, and I'm one of these people lucky enough to have come out of a failed marriage with a friendship. It took a while, as many of your listeners will be able to empathize with. And we were having a conversation, and she was getting ready to remarry. And the first line of that story is, you know, my first ex-wife said, it never occurred to me that I'd be married three times. And I remember thinking, wow. And it just kind of boiled away there in the background or simmered. And I wrote it down, of course, as soon as I got home. I carry a little pocket recorder with me, or I have my smartphone. And if I hear a line that sticks with me, I'll try to record it because I know I'll forget it. And so, yeah, there are pieces in there. It quickly becomes other people. So when she read it, I know that there may have been things that she might have recognized and smiled about. But most of it is pure fiction.
Do you write on a timetable? And the reason I ask that, I heard an interview with Stephen King, the horror writer, the other week, and he said that every day he says, I have to write so many pages, and he'll stick with it no matter how long, how short it takes.
I don't have the, because I have a day job as a professor, I can't spend as many hours writing as I would like. But I've learned to be very careful. I mean, I'm even hesitant to start this paragraph with that sentence because it's so easy to make an excuse. I don't manage to write every day. I do manage to write many days, and I've learned that my best time is very early in the morning, quite often before anybody else in the house is up. So get up, fix a cup of tea, have a piece of toast, take the dog out, not necessarily in that order, and then sit in front of the computer. And sometimes I might have a half hour, and sometimes it might be 15 minutes. Other times, if it's the weekend, I might have much longer than that. And I've learned, this is something that, it took me a long time to figure this out. And talking with other writers, they've come to it in different ways, and they explain it in different ways. But I finally came to realize a few years back, there's no magic to it. There's no muse. Occasionally, there might be inspiration, a line of dialogue or whatnot. Writing is just getting off your butt, pulling yourself out of bed, sitting down in front of the laptop or the pad, and doing it. There's no trick to it. You just have to do it. And A friend of mine who's no longer with us, he was poet laureate of the state of Connecticut, a very interesting guy named Leo Kanellin, 15 books of poetry. I don't write poetry, but I loved talking with him. And he was a no-nonsense kind of guy. And I remember in one, and he liked my writing, which really was affirming to me. And I remember one day in one conversation, he just looked at me and he said, very gruff voice, "Writer's right, Frank, writer's right." And in the morning, often, when I don't want to get up, I hear Leo. Sometimes I'll even say it out loud, not loud enough to wake up my wife, but sometimes I'll just channel Leo. Writer's right, Frank. Writer's right.
At the end of your collection, you have the Digging Up Mr. Bradley, a novel, an excerpt. When is the novel coming out?
Well, I had hoped to be done with it by now, and one of the things that I discovered just about 2 weeks ago, when I was going back through the manuscript, I printed out a draft every once in a while and go back through to make sure certain things are flowing well, I realized that there are a couple of subplots in it, and one of them I really can't ignore. It needs more work. So my feeling now is that I should have the draft done before the end of the year, and I'm hoping I'll be able to after several rewrites. The secret of good writing, Steve, you know this, is rewriting. So I'm hoping that might pick up and we get to talk about it again sometime next year.
Given that most people know you for your voice, will there be an audiobook of The Man Who Built Boxes?
I hadn't thought of that. I admit that may sound like a dumb response, but it hadn't occurred to me. Thank you, Steve. I'm writing that down.
All right. Well, think about that.
Yes. Well, I've been invited to, I do occasional readings, and there are a couple of the literary journals that had published some of these stories have a audio component, and have invited me to do an audio version of the individual story. I've declined on a couple of occasions because, people recognize me as the voice of NPR. Some of these characters are a little profane. I'm not. But the characters are. And I was a little concerned, even though there's nothing in my contract that prevents me from doing anything else with NPR, I was a little concerned, I'm confessing this to you, of having the NPR voice that's associated with a particular purpose with public radio listeners reading the characterizations of some of these stories that are so different from the NPR persona.
Let's talk a little bit about Frank Tavares, the voice guy for NPR. How long have you been voicing the funding credits for National Public Radio?
Well, my short answer, when I want to be vague and not too specific, is from the beginning of funding credits at NPR. In reality, it's been a bit over 30 years, 31 years. We actually started the funding credit concept. I'm remembering it as being 1982, and the idea there was to make the support for foundations and organizations and businesses very clear at the end of the program, with a sort of firewall between the underwriting of the program and the content of the program. We're talking news here. And at the time, I was heading one of the programming departments at NPR and hosting several different programs, but they weren't news programs. So my voice was kind of a safe, neutral voice, and that's how they started.
How do you deal with variations in voice quality from day to day? I mean, you always sound the same to me.
By being obsessive about it. When I know we've got a major session coming up, I start to pay attention to the voice very carefully about 2 days in advance. Allergy season is the worst. I try to stay hydrated. I try to make sure that I only have one teenager in the house right now, but up until the end of August, I had two teens in the house, both males, and so be careful about raising your voice because that can affect things. And I'm careful about what I eat before a session. I'm careful about how soon I eat before a session, what I drink during a session, always just water, sometimes warm water, sometimes decaffeinated tea. Because that's something that I want to make sure that Steve, if you hear something that I recorded at the beginning of the session, in the first half hour of All Things Considered, and then you hear something that I might have recorded towards the end of the session, I want it to have the same energy, and I don't want you to be able to say, ooh, he was really tired there. I don't always pull it off.
Among public radio listeners, your voice is extremely well known. And because of that, do you think most people can do a Frank Tavares impersonation?
I think if they can't, they probably tried. Every once in a while, I find myself doing a Frank Tavares impersonation. When my wife is particularly annoyed with me, she may say something along the lines of, don't use your radio voice.
Is it true that your NPR voice guy days are coming to an end soon?
Listeners may hear a change and a new voice starting as early as it looks like now. It may be the second half of November, early part of December. And earlier in the year, NPR decided that it might be more efficient in terms of the production process that goes on to combine a couple of different positions. You've got Tavares doing the voicing, and there was a full-time producer at NPR, Wendy Blair, who was the person who had been producing the funding credits from day one. She was the one right at the beginning who basically pulled me into the studio almost literally out of the hallway 30-plus years ago to give it a try to see if that might work on the air. And then there's somebody else who does the voicing for the online credits. So the idea was, well, maybe we can pull this all together with one person doing the production and the distribution and the voicing. Then it would also allow them to make changes a little quicker. And normally that hasn't been a problem, but every once in a while we'll have a challenging day where I am making that dash from my campus office home to get something done quickly. So they did a national search starting in the summer. They had a number of people who sent in tapes and applied for it, some of them from stations, some of them voiceover artists, and others that just thought they had a great Frank Tavares impression. I was invited to apply for the position also, but I declined because I have a very full life up here in Connecticut. And I made it clear that I will do anything I can to help the transition. And part of that, helping the transition, is to continue to voice the credits until the new person is trained and really has their legs and is able to make it as smooth as possible. And yes, I have to admit that it's going to be a little funny hearing somebody else doing that. It's only happened twice before in all these years. Both times I was out of the country.
Frank Tavares, the NPR voice guy and author of The Men Who Built Boxes and Other Stories. Frank, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Steve, thank you so much for inviting me to spend a little time with you and with your listeners. I very much appreciate it.